All right, so welcome back to Fictherpology. We are here again with our full panel of ne'er-do-wells. That would be Alanya.
Hello.
Neri.
Hello.
And Aaris.
Hello.
Hello. And me, Luconi. So, here we are. We have two articles to discuss this time, both from the Transformative Works and Cultures Journal, which is a free journal online that's associated with the Organization for Transformative Works, which we will talk about a little bit more later as the articles talk about it itself. We're going to start with, which one are we starting with? We're starting with Silence in the Library, Archives and the Preservation of Fanish History by Versafile from 2011. And I believe Alanya is going to talk a little bit about the article before we discuss it.
Okay, so we're actually going to be talking about two articles in this podcast. And so the first one is Silence in the Library, as Luconi said, and the second one is called An Archive of One's Own, Subcultural Creativity and the Politics of Conservation by Alexis Lothian. And we discussed this before we started recording about what order we should discuss them in and how we want to handle this. And we decided to talk about Silence in the Library first after a little bit of debate, because it sort of presents more of that history. It talks about how fandom has been recorded and presented over time and how that's changed. And then the second article talks more about sort of where fandom is now. It talks a little bit specifically about the Archive of Our Own that the Organization for Transformative Works has created, what the role of that archive is, and also what else is going on in fandom that sort of goes along with or goes against, and sort of the politics of negotiation within fandom and how these sort of ideas relate. And I argued for doing it the way that we're doing it, talking about Silence in the Library first, because I felt that Silence in the Library will give us a better background for understanding what's going on in the second article. So it provides more of that context of history about what some of the issues have been in terms of how fandom has, how the preservation of fandom history has changed over time, and what issues have been dealt with and what they are still currently. And then we can go and talk about some of the current issues that fandom faces. So, yes.
Okay. So I'd say it basically starts and goes from zines and then moves on to the introduction of fandom onto the World Wide Web through Usenets. Which
Henry Jenkins touched on.
That's true.
Yeah.
Specifically with the Twin Peaks fanish communities.
Right.
Yeah. And then I found this interesting because there's a lot of these steps that I sort of was involved with, and then a lot of them that I just missed completely.
Which did you miss?
I think due to the nature of the fandoms that I was engaging with, I think I might have talked about this a little bit back in the introductory post, but my first introduction to fandom was being involved in a role-playing story that grew out of, based on a video game, based on Final Fantasy 3/6, that developed out of a Usenet group, and then was maintained on a private mailing list because that was the easiest way for us to keep everyone involved with the stories. And it was an interactive story, so people were all writing stories in the same world, borrowing other people's characters and so forth. So it was a very big collaborative project, and it is still archived online anyway.
Was it a closed group?
Eventually, yes. When it was still on Usenet, anyone could just sort of jump in at the very beginning because we didn't really know what we were doing. It was a process that evolved as it went. And then over time, it became more close. Once we moved to the media list or to a mailing list, it was harder for people to know about it, but people still did. I mean, we still talked about it on the news group, and so people could still, you know, create new characters or borrow characters from the game. That was the other thing that was interesting to me, is that it was a mix of characters from the original game that it was theoretically based on, from Final Fantasy 3/6. But then people also brought in bunches of characters from Final Fantasy, from earlier Final Fantasy games. So it was, we sort of assumed this canon was all connected somehow. And we all came up with our own collaborative theories about how this worked.
Now wait, if somebody just sort of came in the middle, how hard would it be for them to catch up? Like, what did they have to do to try to track down the original material?
They were archived, and actually I was just thinking that I didn't really connect it when I was reading this at the time, but we did have somebody who collected the stories and put them all online in this sort of archive thing. But it never, for my personal experience, because I didn't really know more about fandom more broadly in that period, I did not connect it. Even when I was reading this article, which talks about, you know, people posting to mailing lists specifically and people creating like archives based on stuff that's being posted to Usenet and to these things and pulling them off and putting them on the web where they're accessible. So that is exactly how it happened. We also had an IRC channel where people could come and talk about, you know, either just talk to each other, hang out as authors, or collaborate on story ideas or whatever.
And that would be the ephemera.
So it was really this sort of isolated fandom space that was doing exactly what fandom everywhere else was doing, but with this really big, broad disconnect from realizing that other people were doing this.
So what Versatophile points out on page 4, I guess, is, or I guess...
Paragraph
7, that that the services created spaces for fandom that were more private, more focused, and better preserved. However, the ease of creation produced a great deal of audience fragmentation.
Yes.
So right. That's exactly what happened.
Exactly.
So everyone goes and plays in their own little corner.
Yeah. I will say I do feel that my fandom experience dealing with the Final Fantasy game stuff was a little bit different. I mean, because it was a very male-centered space, which is not typical in fandom. Most of the writers who were in this group were men, and women were not the most common.
And do you think that was because of the nature of the source material? Or
yes.
Do you think, okay.
I think it's partly a matter of the nature of the source material, and partly because of the time in which I'm talking about, which was sort of like early to mid-90s, where Usenet was more male-dominated, I think, in general.
See, this is so funny, because my introduction to fandom was through college, which was an all-women's college. So,
yeah.
For me, it was my experience in fandom has been almost exclusively female. So it's funny to talk about a male-dominated fanish space,
yeah.
Even though intellectually I've read about them and I understand that they exist. I've just never really been part of one.
Yeah, no, I still, like I said, I still have this huge disconnect of thinking of what, like, I have to train myself to think of, yes, what you were doing really was a fandom kind of project. Like, it was exactly the same thing that was going on in fandom elsewhere. But, like, even after having had that experience, I would still look at people who were writing more traditional forms of fanfic and be like, what are those people doing? That's strange.
Well, I don't want to turn this podcast
yes.
into a...
We're getting
sort of
distracted.
A litany of things that the author missed.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, yes, she's right here, no, she's wrong there. But I was surprised by the omission of any sort of mention to fanfiction.net.
Yeah, me too. That
yes.
was one of the first things I said was, how could you write this whole article about the preservation of fanfiction and the archiving of fanfiction and not even mention fanfiction.net?
Yeah, because for so many people, fanfiction.net was the first stop.
Absolutely,
right?
Yeah.
I know that it was huge for the Tolkien and the Harry Potter and the Star Wars and a lot of these major fandoms,
mega fandoms
which
yeah.
had their sort of broken off niche databases or archives. But fanfic.net really did serve as kind of a giant meeting place and sometimes even it felt like a fanish kiddie pool for newbies.
When do we know when it started? I'm trying to find out. Oh, here it was founded in 1998. So I'm trying to figure out where that falls in her history of what happened. And
is that pre? I mean, that's pretty much as soon as LJ shows up.
Because she talks about the fragmented archive, the individual archives for fandoms, and then
I mean, that's pre-LJ.
That's in the 90s.
That's pre-LJ because LJ
right exactly
was like 2001, I think. I joined it in 2002, and it was still fairly new then. Like,
yeah. And then she talks about mailing lists come before the.
Yeah, she says mailing lists are sort of late 90s.
Late 90s custom mailing lists. And then.
And mailing list services starting with one list and e-group in the late 90s also.
And GeoCities was the.
Yeah.
And then the late 90s, early 2000s.
Yeah.
Right.
Early aughts.
Yeah, and then she said at the same time they were having, like, people were starting to build websites to store individual fandom archives. And then she goes into 2001, LiveJournal. So yeah, she's mm-hmm. totally skips fanfiction.net.
And I don't, I mean, I personally have not used fanfiction.net a lot. It was not something that was a huge part of my fanish experience. Like, I've gone there when people have directed me to specific stories, but I've never really posted anything there.
Well, I think the advantage of talking about fanfiction.net is just how it was one of the most visible fanish sites in the late 90s, before fandom sort of became marginally culturally acceptable. Mm-hmm. I remember reading an article where fanfiction.net, they were talking about the sites where people spend the most time on the internet, and fanfiction.net cracked the top 10.
Oh, wow.
For something like that, because I mean, if you think about it, you do spend a lot of time on these sites. Just because of the nature of the activity that you're doing there. You're going there and reading. You're not going there just to look at pictures or...
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, you can spend a lot of face time on there.
But I know that for myself, it was always a place of derision, I guess.
I think especially early on, there was a lot of trolly comments and people getting really harshed by other people.
Yeah. It didn't feel like a very safe space.
Right.
And I kind of avoided it for that reason.
I think part of the risk of, I mean, it was good because it was open. It had all of these different fandoms in it. So you could, it's sort of one-stop shopping. You can read a bunch of different fandoms in the same place, but then it's that accessibility also made it accessible to trolls and people who were...
And not to be mean, but it was also accessible to, I mean, any it was an automated archive, so anybody could post. There was no quality control.
Yeah.
And I quickly learned that I should wait for recs. I should wait for recommendations before just jumping into fanfiction.net and trying to wade through all the Snape Harry or, you know, Qui-Gon Jinn fix that I wanted.
Yeah. Because if you don't have the patience to cull through all of the crappy stuff, then it can be a pain in the butt.
And there were serious rec lists being posted either through LJ or through various other sites. Mailing lists or even on places like the Smallville Slash Archive.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, in a way, the rec list is kind of serving as an archivist to the broader pool of you know, for instance, fanfiction.net stories.
No, exactly.
It's a finding aid.
It's like filtering it down for you so that you can pick out what's actually to your interest or, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I would essentially treat these as forms of bibliography. You know, I would say, okay, I like this author, I'm going to read everything by them, and I'm going to see what this author recs. Because generally author-based sites, right, mm-hmm. people's personal sites, had their own, you know, fix, but then they also had recs. And they recs their friends, and they recs the BNFs, and they recs the sort of, like, the big fix. But by drawing all those connections, I was able to sort of, like, skirt around just massive archive munching and pull out the stuff that was closer to what I actually wanted to read.
Right.
Although I will say I did read the entire Smallville Slash Archive. And that was terrible and amazing at the same time.
None of that surprises me even a little bit.
Well, that was the great thing. When you could find a good archive, you know, you could just gorge. Gorge.
Oh, it was beautiful and it was terrible. Like, I think back on those nights where I would just, the green and black screen, and I'd just click on it, and I read some amazing fic, and I read some totally terrible fic. But I learned.
Yeah. So, one of to ground us more back in the article again, because I think that if we do want to use this as a stepping point, a mm-hmm. stepping off point to look at the other one, it's going to be worth sort of reviewing some of the points that she makes about some of the pros and cons of these different media as archives and their ability to preserve fanish culture. So I don't know if we each want to take one. I can run through them. I made some notes how we want to handle that.
Well, I mean, we can just start at the beginning and go through, and people who may want to speak on something can jump up. I have very little to say about, for example, zines. I think I've maybe purchased 2 zines in my life. And it's never been part of my fanish experience. Has it been anybody's here?
Nope.
Not really.
No.
But I mean, the point that she makes about zines is that they do have that sort of tangible preservation factor.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
If you can get your hands on them, you can still read them. 20 years later.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I mean, if somebody is out there collecting it, specifically trying to make an archive of Fanish works, which I will note, there are some Fanish materials that are in the science fiction collection at the university where I work.
Mm.
Really?
Yeah, they have
there's
some.
There's a bookstore in a town near me that I have definitely seen Fanish material at in an archival setting.
Yeah. So, I mean, there are people who are there who are specifically preserving Fanish history in that form.
Yeah.
And that's at least worth mentioning in terms of...
And I mean, this is a broader archival issue anyway, is preserving digital material, period. Because
yes,
it is so hard to keep it in a form that is still going to be readable in 10 years, 20 years, to keep the sort of context of it. Like, if there are links, well, the links break, then you don't have that context anymore. If there was an image, the image gets, you know, deleted off the server, and now there's no picture anymore. Just sort of all the bits and pieces that go into an online document that are not a factor for a paper document, where,
mm-hmm.
where, like, okay, there may be preservation issues, there may be, you know, maybe the print is fading, or maybe it's, you know, crumbling or falling apart, but I guess archivists have experience in dealing with that, and we don't have experience yet in long-term digital preservation, and everybody is struggling with this, and nobody knows what the right answer is.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, and I've definitely had some stories that back in those early days, I just printed them out on paper because I didn't know if I would be able to get access to them later, and
mm-hmm.
it's like I still have those, I think, somewhere.
I actually, there was a period of time where I print out live journal entries of friends of mine that I thought were valuable to my understanding of certain television shows, and that I didn't want to have to like scroll through the archive, the live journal archive,
right,
in order to get access to them. So I just printed them out.
Yep.
Yeah.
I had no idea, you know, you can create bookmarks or something, but I was like, nope, I'm going to have a hard copy of these.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have a friend of mine who prints a copy, an entire copy of her live journal every year because she doesn't trust that it will actually be accessible.
Interesting.
In the long term.
Yep.
So every she comes around every year, she just prints out every post that she's made and puts it in an actual book.
Wow. Can she print out the comments too, or just the?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah, I have mine backed up. They have the whatever it's called, LJ book or something.
Right.
And I've backed up mine that way, but I've never actually done it as a printed version, but I have the file, so if in theory LiveJournal disappears from the face of the internet, I can have that backup.
Right.
All right. So
so the hard copy is great, but we have a whole lot of stuff that's not going to be on hard copy.
Right.
Yeah.
And
I think that, I mean, one thing we maybe want to mention is the tension in each of these different forms of archiving, I guess, between the rights and privacy of the author versus the, I guess,
accessibility.
The accessibility and the openness of the material, whether
mm-hmm.
whether it's going to be something that's available and visible and publicly searchable,
right,
versus the right of an author to say, actually, I don't want that there anymore, and, you know, to take it
yeah.
down or
yeah.
Yeah.
Whatever.
And I think also that tension is important to considering issues of preserving Fanish culture. I mean, if you think that there's a story that was very important to, you know, to a particular fandom or to somebody's experience of fandom, for good or for bad, you know, it becomes an issue of, well, that story belongs to somebody and they deserve to have control over it, but we want to have some record that it existed so that we can understand its influence.
But then an author doesn't have control. Like, once their book is published, mm-hmm. they don't have control over who gets to read that book anymore. So,
or who gets to write about their characters?
Or who gets to write about their characters?
Exactly.
So then it's interesting to say, oh, well, they once, you know, this person has posted it on the internet, but they're the author and they can take it down whenever they want. But then you're like, but it's in the public sphere.
Right. And you can take it down
from
wherever
your site.
You posted it,
yeah.
but you have no idea whether other people may
have printed it out
yes. or copied it, or, you know, saved it to their own hard drive or whatever they may have done. So yeah, you can try to take something down, but if it's something that mattered to someone and that someone has bothered to go to the effort to preserve, then it can still be
right
a part of Fannish history, I guess, in that sense. And I mean, like Alanya was saying, I mean, for negative as well as positive, I mean, you know, people will take sort of, I don't know what the word is I'm looking for here, but I guess basically like preservation kind of screen caps to say like, look, this was here. In the event that this person takes this down, I want to be able to show what this actually said,
that,
you know?
That ties into the next article we're going to write when we talk about fandom ephemera and fan wink.
Yeah.
Yay!
Because people often do take down stupid things they've said on the internet or discussions that they don't want circulated.
Right.
But people also take screen caps in order to be able to share that discussion with other people. And I don't know, there was kind of an assumption, I'm not sure if it was a real assumption, but in both articles, that there's this idea of sort of a communal Fannish history, an overarching narrative, and that we should be striving for some sort of, or that some people are striving for some sort of complete narrative.
Yeah.
Which, I'm not saying it bothers me, because I generally fall down on the side of, yes, I would like the complete narrative. Give me all the information possible. If it's not complete, I feel like I'm missing something.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also troubling that then what gets preserved becomes assumed as being the complete narrative.
Right.
And then this is something that, you know, historians and classicists and everyone has to deal with as soon as we start talking about literature and stories and history and how we understand the past. But it felt like so much of what these articles were driving at is not just about creating a Fannish space that will meet the challenges going forward, you know, challenges of how do we preserve and how do we ensure that people have privacy at the same time maintaining accessibility, but also wanting to create almost this cultural memory deposit.
Yes.
So that we can look back and say, remember back in, you know, the great race fail wank of 2011? Where were you there? You know, that sort of...
So the people like, will know we were here.
Yes.
Right? We had the discussion 3 years ago on Fanwank. Stop it.
Yeah.
Right.
Which I think goes towards looking at, you know, who participates in fandom and who decides what fandom looks like and where Archive of Our Own features into that.
Yes. Sorry, I was just looking up. I wanted to see when these articles were written. I wanted to remind myself, and I'm not...
2011.
They're both published in 2011.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What I wanted to see was when the Organization for Transformative Works wiki, Fanlore, was started.
And yes,
that was actually started in 2007.
Yeah. Did they mention wiki? Yes, I think that she does.
Yeah. They did in... I think in the archive of one's own article. Yeah.
All right. Do we want to say anything more about Silence in the Library specifically? I think we've touched on the big we didn't go through all of the different platforms that.
Yeah.
I
guess one thing I did want to touch on briefly is the idea of the searchability function.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because I think that that's kind of important too. I mean, that there is the privacy versus accessibility, but part of the accessibility is the searchability. It's not just saying, yes, there are 10,000 stories here that you can read, but it's being able to sift those stories in some way so that you don't have to read 10,000 stories to find the 50 that you really want to read.
Yeah. And that's what she points out as a real weakness of live journal, is that you can't.
Absolutely.
Do that
I mean,
at all.
There's no good live journal search, really, of any kind. And you kind of have to know. The only reason that LiveJournal works as a fandom platform for me is because you can connect through people and you can sort of say, like, okay, you know, here's a person who's interested in the same thing as me, and then you can sort of look at what communities they're part of and you can go and join them that way, or you know, you can sort of follow these little breadcrumb trails. There's no
it's
good way to search it. Yeah. You can look at you can look at Rex lists and, you know, follow things that way.
Can I just interject a question?
Yeah.
When did Delicious shut down? Because I remember there was a moment in which people were pairing LiveJournal with Delicious, and that was working well. Like, you went to somebody's Delicious account, and then they had all their recs there with the brief descriptions of the fix.
Delicious is still up, but it's now like...
It's now, what is it, pay to play or...
Yeah, well, it's... You can still browse it. I'm trying to remember how it has changed since the changes, but it is still there. You can still browse people's bookmarks and stuff. There was sort of a flurry of panic of, oh no, Delicious is going away and we're going to lose all our bookmarks and whatever. But it didn't actually, as far as I could tell, I never used Delicious that heavily, but as far as I could tell, the apocalyptic predictions didn't come to pass, or at least not in the way that people were expecting.
What? A whole bunch of people got the wrong idea and made accusations based on it? That has never happened in human history.
Yeah.
Especially not on the internet.
A site got sold to someone else and people panicked. Oh my god. Things are going to change.
Right. Well, change is frustrating.
Yeah.
Especially on the internet, because then you have to find out new ways to do stuff and you just got used to the old way they did stuff. And
well, I think that's part of the reason that Archive of Our Own has become... I think people just... Once they were dissatisfied with the service that Delicious was providing, for whatever reason, they sort of moved their base of operations to Archive of Their Own.
Well, I think there was more to setting up Archive of Our Own, because there was also that whole section of people trying to take down offensive material and authors having no place to put stuff that wasn't going to be censored by the server owners and things like that. So I think Archive of Our Own was also related to that. Yeah.
And also to protect material that was going was on servers that was being shut down for various other reasons.
Oh, right, for copyright infringement. And
Or even just like when GeoCities went under kind of things.
Well, No, but I mean that the reason that Archive of Their Own became so prominent among my friends is because Delicious was no longer a viable option for many people.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Not the impetus for creating Archive of Their Own, but one of the reasons that it sort of has become, I guess, you know, if we're looking at fandom as a market and where they're taking their money, capital, something, their goods. Archive of Their Own, like, came in and conquered the market, essentially.
Yeah. Okay, so should we talk, or do we want to keep talking about searching things, or Neri, did you have more to say?
No, I think that I just wanted to raise that as another issue in terms of accessibility and in terms of what a successful or, you know, a good, to my mind, fandom archive is going to be able to do. And to me, that having some kind of workable, searchable mechanism is really important for me, because I don't have the patience to sift through 10,000 things.
Yeah.
Or the time, exactly. And, you know, Rex lists.
We're not college students anymore.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, and it's nice, too, with AO3, how you can search for keywords across multiple fandoms. So sometimes you're just like in the mood for, I don't know, a foot massage story or something like that. And then you can be like, hey, look, there's a keyword for foot massage. I wonder who else has those. And it's kind of fun if you're just sort of bored with the same stuff you've been reading for a while, or if you like exploring. And it helps you access other fandoms. Whereas like a lot of those earlier sites where it was just like, this is a Gundam Wing only archive. That's all you could ever read. And it's sort of nice to have this option too.
Or where if it was searchable, it was searchable by the character, for instance, maybe, or something like
pairing,
or the pairing,
or the pairing, exactly.
Was searchable by pairing and by like rating. Or
rating,
something.
Yeah,
yeah,
but not for instance searching for like you said, you know, all the stories that have, you know, cuddling or whatever as a keyword.
Right.
Yeah. Honestly, one of the ways I use that search function is if I'm going to be writing a story that is new to me, that contains something new to me, or that I'm not super familiar with myself, is I'll go and look and see what other people have written about it and see if I can get good ideas, or, you know, ideas to stay away from, or see what's been done 1,050,000 times already.
Huh.
So that if I then want to write my very first story about foot massage, I'm not going to be, you know, I can, you know, ground it in tropes that are familiar without, you know, just retreading the same old ground that everybody else does in their foot massage stories.
Right. Oh, they're taking off his shoes again. Whatever.
And you can avoid some of the more problematic terminology.
Yes.
In foot massage stories and what things to warn for.
Right.
I actually have a question.
Calluses.
Bunions.
Toe jam.
I actually have a question for Neri. And it's a bit unkind. Not an unkind question for you, but sort of something that I do enjoy about AO3. And this may be a product of the searchability function, but it's not a cesspool of terrible fic. Is there any sort of quality control or Or is it just question of who posts there?
There's no quality control. I guess the only way that that sort of access to posting is controlled is that you need to get an invite to become a member, but they're not...
People give those out like candy.
They're handing them out. They have a backlog. For a while, they had slowed down the rate they were handing them out just for keeping the load on the site at a more manageable level, because there was a while when it was sort of crashing constantly. And I think we can probably blame that on Avengers mostly. They've upped the rate that they're handing them out again now, as far as I can tell. I requested one for my husband a little while ago, and it took a couple days, kind of thing. Like, it didn't take ages to get it. And yeah, other than that, there's not any kind of screening or vetting of who's going to post there or of the stories that get posted. I don't know how to account for it being, because I agree with you that, you know, if you sort of take the average quality of stories there, it feels very high to me. There are a lot of really good stories there, and I have not run across a lot of terrible ones just in my reading there.
But... Do you think people are self-selecting?
Maybe.
I do. I think, if I can interject here, part of it is that not everyone does necessarily agree with the project that AO3, with that project in terms of creating this accessible archive and, you know, making everything a Creative Commons or trying to encourage that kind of sharing, the concept of transformative works. I think it appeals more to a certain kind of fan who is more interested in sort of fandom meta, in what fandom is, what's going on in sort of the history, and as opposed to just, I want to write stories about what turns me on or what interests me.
So do you think it's just that people don't see the value, or do you think that they're actively opposed to such a place?
I think there's both going on. I mean, there definitely are people who are not comfortable with the archive, with its project. And then I think that there are people who just aren't interested.
I mean, it may be
that, you know, they have their own quarters. Of fandom where they can play. They find places maybe where they can get more feedback. That sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it is to some degree sort of self-selecting, that the way the archive presents itself tends to attract a certain kind of fan, and I don't know, you know, whether we can actually back this up in any way. This is just my impressions. But that it's, you know, the sort of overwhelming sense I get there is of a sort of somewhat older group of fans, fewer teenagers and really young people. Do you think you think there are a lot of teenagers? I don't know.
I see a lot of overlap in the fandom, in the Teen Wolf fandom.
Oh, that could be, yeah. I mean, it could just be the fandoms that I'm reading in, but...
You know, it's true. But the thing that I find interesting is that the people on Tumblr, because they post fic on Tumblr, and it bothers me to no end, because I'm old.
Tumblr.
And then they post the fic on archive of their own, AO3, and it's the stuff that's being posted on AO3 is, in my opinion, superior to what is being just thrown out there on Tumblr. Now, it may be true that the nature of Tumblr being so ephemeral, it becomes essentially comment fic.
Right. Yeah.
That no one wants to put up on AO3. But there is a steady stream of Teen Wolf fics going up on AO3, and some are good and some are less than good. But overall, it's a good effort for a fandom that skews very young.
Now, my question is, because using Teen Wolf specifically, like, that's a very new fandom.
Yes.
Right? Like, it's a new show, and it's got a mix of people who are more established in fandom, who just know that that's the kind of show that, you know, creates the kind of character dynamics that make for good stories. And also younger people who are just getting into fandom and who are connecting to those older fans in this context. And so I'm wondering if we're seeing that sort of that community connection in terms of drawing people into the archive of our own.
Maybe, but the funny thing is that the funny thing, and it's not funny, but I sort of see the younger section, the younger kids seem to be taking a real sort of leadership position in the Teen Wolf fandom in general. And I think they're the ones who are driving a lot of the Teen Wolf's presence on Archive of Our Own. And I honestly, if I didn't have a Tumblr, I wouldn't be in contact with them.
Right.
I mean, they're essentially the reason I got a Tumblr. You know, there are people from my FLIS, from my LJ list, that are into Teen Wolf now, and that I do like to talk to about the show and about various fic. But the driving force of fandom is the younger crowd, is the, like, 17 to 19-year-olds who are just super into it, and they are into it not from a place of hiding or a place of understanding that we are marginal or liminal somehow, but they are right out there in the front. And so for them, Archive of Our Own makes perfect sense.
Right.
Yeah. I think it's interesting that you raise the question of community and that the sort of discussion between fans, that sort of casual back and forth, mm-hmm. Is not what's happening on AO3. Like that doesn't,
yeah, it doesn't work.
It doesn't
AO3
work
at all.
There. And I have like zero sense of community on AO3, except as part of like fandom as a whole.
Right.
I don't
yeah,
have
I
a sense
you,
of like,
if you play in certain fandoms, you start seeing names, you can connect
sure.
them.
Sure.
Like, oh, that's
yeah.
them on LJ and I can go friend them there. Or that's them on Tumblr. Or that's them on Twitter. And you can make these
yeah,
connections.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are people that I made those connections with on other platforms that I have
right.
then, you know, found on AO3 and have, you know, made sure to subscribe to their fix or whatever. But even then,
yeah.
if I'm gonna talk to them about, you know,
yes.
the recent
it's not on AO3.
Book or episode or whatever it is, I'm not gonna talk about it there. I'm gonna talk about it on LiveJournal or wherever.
Yeah.
I will say that sometimes I have seen discussions in the comments on fic, and it's usually about the say political or racial or it's discussions that usually deal with archive warnings or issues of consent or issues of sort of privilege or race, and people are quick to turn the comment sections into these sorts of discussions.
On
AO3. But aside from those, on AO3, at least in the fandoms that I read in at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
So Teen Wolf and Hockey. So there is a level of discussion that is going on, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it isn't the sort of nitty-gritty, let's discuss character motivation or what's exactly the timeline for this character's progression from this point to that point.
Right.
Or even just, you know, oh my god, I can't believe what happened in
yes.
last night's episode, that kind of thing.
Someone's a
right.
werewolf?
Yeah.
I'm going to step in here. I'm going to interrupt the conversation because we are treading into territory that is being discussed in the second article, the Lothian article, and I think that it might be worthwhile, again, just to ground us a little bit more in that discussion to talk specifically about what she is saying in terms of what the Archive of Our Own project does and also how other forms of fandom ephemera relate to that.
Mm-hmm.
Because she does... What I found really is that she's getting at sort of looking at the archive, and she doesn't use it or in this terminology or in this sense, but it really made me think of sort of in a Marshall McLuhan sense, and I'm probably saying his name wrong, but that the medium is the message.
McLuhan.
Mm-hmm.
That the Archive of Our Own, the Organization for Transformative Works, wants to create this image of what fandom is and what it can be and how we can make our presence acceptable and how we can work towards getting these goals of having, you know, less persecution of fan writers in terms of, you know, being sued for copyright infringement and all of that stuff.
Yeah, a lot of the legal issues.
Right. And so they've created this space and they've, you know, and then this is the experience of fandom they're presenting. And so as Neri pointed out, it's very devoid of a lot of what fandom is. And Lothian talks specifically in the third section of her article about wank and about fandom wank, and about how you get these conversations between fans about fandom, like not necessarily about, you know, specific episodes of a show or whatever, but about fandom itself that's going on in these other spaces that represent another form of fandom politics. So the AO3 is very sort of unified, singular presence that presents a very coherent image. And we talked about this a little bit earlier about, you know, this idea of, do we want, you know, are we working toward this single fandom concept?
Yeah.
Whereas a space like Fandom Wank really provides something different.
Yeah. I think that part, when you were saying that AO3 and, you know, OTW are sort of presenting this particular image of fandom, the first thing I thought was, and it's this really safe professional,
yes.
Whole, not wholesome exactly, that's maybe not the word I'm looking for, but it's like a legitimate, you know,
hobby.
This is totally normal. People, you know, of all walks of life do this, and we support this, and, you know, it's a very safe and inclusive kind of vibe.
Right.
And for some fandoms, I think it works, and it can be extremely beneficial. But, you know, just as, for example, the kids in the Teen Wolf fandom seem to have no problem putting their stuff out there, the opposite is true in the hockey fandom. Because it's RPF, and because it's RPF in a very, very male sphere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And one which people do have huge lawsuits in, and there are big issues on, and there are tons and tons of sports blogs out there. People are probably rightfully extremely wary of how they're perceived and how their various online personas can get linked up, and if any of that can be traced back to their real life. I know, for example, recently, like maybe a couple weeks ago, one of the star players of the Boston Bruins tweeted a link to a primer that a fan had made about him and another player that he is commonly slashed with. And he himself is part of this, sort of, because he and this other guy have this bromance going, and they talk about it a lot, and they refer to each other as husband and wife, and so on some level, I think he read it as kind of like a joke. Ha ha ha, everyone thinks that me and this other guy are super good friends. That's awesome. But a lot of people freaked out. And some people were like, I don't care if people find out that this is what I think about the players or that I write this stuff. And other people were like, I care. I care very much. I'm not ashamed of being a fan. I just really care.
Right.
I don't want everyone to find out and get totally creeped out about their female fans doing this.
Sure.
So, see, it's a hard line to walk.
Yeah.
But getting back to the article, it's just interesting what should be, whether we really need to preserve the discussions about what we're writing, and whether in traditional literary history we're lucky when we find someone's journal or marginalia or something, but it's not like guaranteed that you're going to find that. And so
but who are we preserving it for?
Yeah.
You know, are we writing for some like digital archaeologists in, you know, 1,000 years into the future?
Always.
Which, by the way, would be a really good science fiction novel.
Yeah.
But or are we writing for our own understanding, the construction of our own memory? You know, is this a monument?
I don't think it needs to be an or issue.
Yeah. Well, but who is the audience? Is it ourselves?
Like, for me, a successful archive for me is one where I can find the stories that I want to read. And then if I happen to, like, get some other information about, I don't know, an old conversation somebody had about a story or something, that can be a bonus, or it can be really boring material that I don't care about.
Man,
what?
You know what's a perfect example for all of this?
Ghost soup.
Ghost soup.
Yes.
Infinite Blue. So Yuletide this year, somebody put it, and I know I've talked about the ghost soup phenomenon before, the sort of fake invented fandom.
Somebody
requested, you know, say, does anybody have any meta about this fandom? And so somebody wrote them this fictional piece that was an archived discussion from a forum that was theoretically on this old GeoCities site that had disappeared. And so they're like, look, I saved these snippets of conversation. You can have them. And of course, they're completely invented. But, you know, and then they brought out, like, in the discussion, you know, in the comments, because Ghost Soup is one of those fandoms where, because it's invented and it's sort of based on this sort of imagined experience
right.
that or imagined shared experience of fandom,
yeah,
which
it hurts my brain.
All kinds of fascinating. People were jumping in about, like, you know, oh, I remember the flame wars about, you know, the how did their jumpers close? Did they use zippers or buttons and like
or Velcro or
yes, like all of these, like, you know. Like the you know,
it's like the Harry
in.
Potter robe issue.
Yeah, but it was but, you know, like,
but
gosh.
It's all made up.
Yeah,
by this collective group of fans that have never seen a show because there is no show.
But what got me is the interest in this shared imagination in preserving that history.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Did anyone see the movie Be Kind, Rewind?
Yes.
This kind of reminds me of that movie with Jack Black and Mos Def.
Were they Swede of the movies?
Yes.
Oh, yes, actually. I have
seen
that. And
then they create this fake documentary at the end about the history of their town, and even though it's totally fake, the entire town starts doing talking head segments and
right.
this and that about how this town is really the birthplace of, you know, jazz in New York or something. It was,
yes,
I remember watching this and being like, this is fandom. It was poorly marketed.
It was. It was hilarious. And it does, it reminds me a lot of that, yeah, that sort of concept.
Yeah. But then who wants to read those conversations? A lot of it is the people who used to participate and they're feeling nostalgic. And then
yes.
when they're out of fandom or passed away, does anyone else want to go back and read that? Especially with the amount of information in the universe that's being preserved at this point.
Well, can I say something with this? When you just said passed away, it reminded me of on LiveJournal, you can, I'm not sure exactly how the process goes, but if someone on LJ passes away, you can actually preserve their LiveJournal.
Mm-hmm.
I know that this happened with Amiris, who was one of my big fanish influences. And when she passed away, people got together and managed to find a way to preserve her LiveJournal. As it is, so
right.
with all comments there, everything she posted, you can't add to it, but you also can't take away from it.
Interesting.
And I do go back.
Right.
And I do read stuff that she said, either to me or to other people, because she was such a resource for me.
Right.
As a newbie in fandom.
Yeah. Well, and I think the LiveJournal format is, people write blog posts and things on their LiveJournals that include information that's very valuable. And less ephemeral than the chats on an IRC channel or something like that. And so at what level do you feel you need to preserve fandom, you know, down to what level of detail? And
yeah. And I mean, there are some things that you, short of someone taking a conscious effort, a decision to preserve, are not ever going to be preserved.
Yes.
Like you said, like chats in, you know, in an instant messenger or you know, a IRC mm-hmm. chat room or whatever. And also I was thinking about things like draft copies of stories. I mean, the way I write, I never have an original draft of my story. I'm editing in the actual file.
Mm-hmm.
I'm changing things. I'm deleting things and whatever.
Right.
You know, so if I ever wanted to say, oh, this was the draft and this is the final version, I can't.
right.
You know, unless on a very few occasions when I'm like, I'm going to make major changes to this, I'd better save a second copy kind of thing so that I can go back if I realize, oh, I didn't want to delete that.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
But, you know, I usually don't do that. It's not usually the way I edit. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's just these things will vanish and there's nothing that can be done about
right.
it.
Which has been true of of writing throughout history.
Absolutely.
You often just get the final version.
And even the communities behind writing. I mean, if you look at, like, the Inklings or other sort of literary communities that have existed throughout history, there aren't minutes of, well, there rarely are minutes of their meetings.
Yeah.
And yet, you know that they were exchanging ideas and, you know, arguing or yelling or,
mm-hmm.
you know, fighting and then making up or something. I mean, you as a fandom, we have cons, and cons are kind of this awesome experience for everybody, or for some people. They should be an awesome experience for everybody.
Right.
And you get to go and hang out with other fan. And sometimes people do put up pictures and have con reports, but it's, you know,
you're
it,
not
it's
saving
like,
all that information.
You had to be there.
Yeah.
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 I mean, I do think, like, when you mentioned the Inklings, for instance, like, we do still have correspondence and journals and things like that.
Yes.
Whereby we can try to reconstruct
what an Inklings meeting may have been like,
what they might have been saying to each other, and maybe that's what the equivalent is of a live journal post or community these days is like is the equivalent of that kind of correspondence between friends where you write and say, this is what I'm working on right now, and you know, these are some ideas I had, what do you think of them?
Well, in a way that takes the place of letters for old authors that we study, and we don't have that anymore.
So I just went back and I actually opened the Ghost Soup Forum Archives story, which is by Chocolate Jedi. I will credit her appropriately. Was written for Elfrek as the one who requested it, who has actually written some of the other Ghost Soup stories that are in the archive. And what I wanted to do was sort of, since we were talking about, you know, well, why would this stuff be preserved, is to go and look and see at what comments people were making about why they were happy to see this posted. And again, keeping in mind that it is an imaginary context. And so most people took the perspective of, yes, this is something I used to be involved with, and this is nostalgic for me. Mm-hmm. And gosh, you know, I remember all these flame wars and blah, 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 and whatever. But there's a couple of people who were like, oh, wow, you know, I'm so glad, you know. Here we go. This comment here from FineSharp. Is that the actual thread that spawned the Space Jesus / Ryan AU? I always wondered about that. I feel I missed so much of the fandom sticking to LiveJournal. Thanks for sharing. Or somebody else. Let me find the other one I was looking at just a second ago. Here we go. By Andrast, I'm not sure how they pronounce it, obviously. Thank you so much for saving this stuff. By the time I got into the fandom, the old forums had gone kablooey, so it's nice to see someone rescued something. And now I know why people twitch whenever someone mentions zippers. and then, wow, things really do, by Ren True Song, sorry, or Ray Ren. Wow, things really never do change, do they? I never imagined so much was involved in Ghost Soup. I've only seen little bits of that Indigo thing, and that keeps getting banned and dumped and hacked on YouTube and things. I'm trying to get a hold of the manga so I can, like, you know, these comments that are basically saying, you know, we're glad that this history is there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously, it's not really there.
So, yeah, I mean, I guess it does provide background information for people who are very into the fandom but have come into it later.
Yeah.
Or came into it from a different route.
Or different media, yeah.
Right.
So it does have that kind of a function, but how many people are really going to go through all of that to make it worth consciously archiving that kind of material?
Yeah. And I mean, I think Lothian's point was specifically that the things that kind of discussion provides, that you know, that we get with Fandom Wank, that those discussions that are ephemeral,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
are more important in the moment than historically. And I think that her point really is that we don't, like, this provides an alternate, like, whereas the archive of our own is a very political thing. It's a very political entity. Mm-hmm. It very much has a message and a purpose that it is trying to further. This provides an alternate place for politics of fandom to occur.
Uh-huh.
And that's important. And that trying to solidify that, like, as soon as you try and capture it, it's like writing down an oral history, right? Mm-hmm. As soon as you write it down, you've made it permanent and it changes its context. And that we need to have that space for ephemera as well in order to keep fandom sort of more liberated,
mm-hmm.
where we can have the unsafe conversations and have things that are a little bit less, you know, professional and less pristine, because that stuff is important too.
Yeah. And one thing I would say, I mean, to come back to ARS's question about to what degree is the archive of our own sort of moderated or controlled? I mean, there is, for instance, the capability to report abuse. Like, if somebody is being really offensive to you in comments, you can report them, and, you know, there's a team who will deal with and try to moderate and you know, if necessary, you know, remove people if they're being really abusive to others. And
mm-hmm.
so there is that degree of moderation, I guess, which
mm-hmm.
is pretty much the antithesis of Fandom Wank.
Right, that's true.
I mean, the idea that someone, that Wank could, at least in theory, if the people involved, you know, get butthurt enough, be moderated away.
Yes. Right.
Okay, well, we've been talking for almost an hour, so...
Next time?
Maybe we should just move on to Rex. Yeah, I was thinking just to wrap it up.
Alrighty. So who wants to go first?
I'll go.
Okay, go ahead. Knock yourself out. Oh, wait. Before we start, we decided to pick, because th- this is being recorded at the end of January, so since our last recording session, Yuletide has happened, so
Yuletide.
We decided
Yay, Yuletide.
That we would all specifically pick a story that came out of this year's Yuletide story to rec. So.
And for people who don't know, Yuletide is an annual fic exchange of rare fandoms, so none of the big ones will be in there, but it's fun and lots of creativity happens, so we love it.
Yes. All right, should I lay it on you?
Lay it on us, baby.
All right. Well, the fic that I chose is a fic called Mutating the Labyrinth by, and I'm going to butcher the name here, Cinaed? I don't know. C-I-N-A-E-D. And it's a fic that looks at the story of Ariadne, Theseus, and the Labyrinth. And it's categorized in the Greek and Roman mythology fandom, which is always a fandom that gets, or fandom genre, something, a category that gets a lot of entries every Yuletide that I read with great delight, because I love Greek and Roman mythology, and I love reading different people's interpretations of different fics. And this one did two things, this fic did two things that made me utterly fall in love with it. And the first is that it set it in space. And there's
awesome.
Nothing so good that if you... It can't be improved by being set in space. except stuff that's already set in space. So taking the Bronze Age heroes and putting them in space and having Crete be a planet and Athens be a planet and their ships be spaceships.
Awesome.
It was fantastic, and it created this universe that I totally would love to see played in and possibly even play in myself. And the second thing that the author did that made me say, ah, this is what I absolutely have to rec, is that the central relationship in this story is not Ariadne and Theseus, which is for many the central relationship in the myth. It's Ariadne and her siblings, primarily the Minotaur, who in this fic gets a name. And so it's the story of Theseus being told in space from the point of view of Ariadne and what exactly her motivations are for helping Theseus and for leaving with him and his motivations for abandoning her on the planet of Naxos in this case. And it's quite good and I kind of want to write in this world now, so.
Cool.
So thank you, Sinead. I'm sorry for butchering your name. I really love your fic.
Excellent. All right. Anyone else next?
I can go next.
Okay.
Sure.
So the fic that I wanted to rec is called Strange Geometry, and it's by Anchoret. And this is I don't know if I want to call it a crossover exactly, but it's a sort of amalgam of the Cthulhu mythos and Holmes on Holmes.
I read this one. It was so good. I loved it.
Yeah.
Which, for those who don't know, Holmes on Holmes is basically a show about a home renovation contractor, I guess, named Mike Holmes, who goes to people's houses who have had sort of disastrous things happen to their homes, maybe, you know, really bad, you know, water damage or floods or fire or whatever, or really bad other repair work that, you know, was shoddily done, and he comes in and fixes it, basically. And so the premise of this story is that they're filming a Holmes on Holmes episode in a house that has a rather unusual problem, which is that it has some kind of horrible eldritch portal in the basement.
So awesome.
And so he goes in and he fixes it. And the thing that I love most about this story, I think, is that there is no eldritch evil that actually appears, you know, because Mike fixes it.
Right.
It's just the dread.
Yeah.
Well, and the challenge of not being lured to open the door.
Yeah. And the mm-hmm. the sort of concept of you know, in Lovecraftian sort of fic of the wrong geometry, the angles that aren't quite right, being fixed by a builder. You know, and,
awesome.
And it sort of introduces this you know, little concept of like this idea that there are these master builders who can fix these things, and they have some kind of maybe secret society or something or knowledge
right.
that's been passed down from, you know, their forefathers. But that's not really the main point of it. I mean, it's really just about Mike Holmes fixing this guy's house so it's not evil anymore.
Yeah, yep. It was great.
Yeah.
It was. It was really subdued. Like, you know, they did it very well. Like, they dealt with the Cthulhu stuff very obtusely. Like, it was there and it was present, but it was not, you know, and you know, they did things like they all had to take shifts
so that they're not
working on it, so that it wouldn't mess with their heads too much.
Yeah.
And there was sort of this, like, this relationship between Mike and one of the younger people on his crew, where, like, Mike and one of his other buddy, like, I don't watch the show that much. I read the fic anyway because I'm a huge Cthulhu fan, and I'm familiar enough with the concept that I could grasp it. But so it was Mike and one of his other, like, more senior guys sort of working with this other younger person on the crew, and sort of, like, them sharing this knowledge of past experience of having dealt with the same kind of Eldritch portal sort of problem, and, you know, the stuff that they felt and, you know, that they knew worked, and, you know, this younger person sort of getting initiated into that knowledge. It was really
right.
It was cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So yes, I also wanted to say I loved it for the Canadian content. I mean, it was,
yeah.
It was plainly,
there was lots,
you know,
of...
all sorts of back bacon all over that story.
Yeah.
Go Canada.
Oh, Canada.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, I'll go and I'll start the next rec then.
Okay.
Because it's also very place centric. I'm gonna rec the story that was written for me. I'm gonna be that person, be that egotistical.
Fine.
It's called "The Butterfly Also Casts a Shadow." Yeah, by Mercury. And it is in the Shadow fandom, and this is I'm a huge Shadow fan and I'm a huge Shadow fangirl, but there's not a whole lot of modern fandom out there for it. And I like it in all of its different flavors. So I've read the different magazines and I've, you know, watched all of the movies, even the really horrible ones that were made in like the 50s and 60s. I've seen the horrible, horrible, awesome, awesomely bad Talking Tiger Head movie serial. I've seen the 1994 movie, which I love. And so when I made my request, I was like, just use any of it. Anything you're comfortable with using, whatever you're familiar with, knock yourself out. Like, I've read the comics, I know it. The author, Malcolm D, chose to base it primarily, oh yes, also the radio show, she chose to base it primarily on the movie. So it's got some things that are very distinct to that. But she also took a lot of material from the radio shows and sort of wove it into the relationship that was created in the movie between Lamont Cranston, who is the Shadow, and Margot Lane. It's first of all, it's case fic, which is
awesome.
Always delightful. And it's set in New York City on New Year's Eve during a snowstorm. So it's got this very, again, this good sort of sense of place and time on it. Like, it's, you know, it's New Year's Eve, and I can't remember what year it is, like 1936 or something, 1933. So, you know, it's got that song, that strong sense of place and time, you know, that references to like the clothing designers and stuff like that, all these little details. And then just really drawing on that established canon and weaving them together just really brilliantly into an exciting, interesting story that tells us new things about the characters and develops their relationships. And it was just very brilliantly done. I was just super excited. I had to read it in short spurts because I couldn't handle how awesome it was in one sitting.
So cool. I enjoyed it too. I definitely second your recommendation.
Yeah. And she did it. She set up the sort of villain of the piece in a really interesting way, and then she let him get away at the end. And so I'm hoping that she will write more.
Sequel.
So yes, that's my recommendation. And other people who are less familiar with The Shadow than me have also read it and enjoyed it. So don't feel like my obsession is a prerequisite to your enjoyment. There are people who don't know The Shadow at all who have read it and enjoyed it. So
really,
cool.
Does anybody truly know The Shadow?
No.
No.
No one does.
The Shadow knows. Okay, well, I'm going to go with a story that wasn't written for me, but although I did love the stories that were written for me, I got two Big Valley fics and I was very happy. So thank you both, my awesome writers.
But I have chosen one that just made me laugh, and that's mainly the reason I chose it, because I haven't been laughing very much at fic lately, and it was nice to just laugh out loud. So I am picking, it's called The Not Remotely Secret Memoirs of Alexander the Great, Aged 13 and 3 Quarters, by Aristea. And it's pretty much what you would expect of Alexander the Great, just being ornery and grandiose and adolescent and angry at being sent to his room, and but also clever and also longing to find true love, and then revealing bits of gossip about his family, and also lots of foreshadowing that is interesting, that, you know, is gonna come to fruition later in his life. So I don't know, I thought it was a lot of fun, and just the voice of this young, brilliant, but just egotistical, awesome kid is just funny. And so there you go, I wanted to laugh and I did.
Laughter is good.
Yes. Okay, and that's it for me, and that's it for this episode. Please join us next time when we will be tackling two articles, John Fiske's The Cultural Economy of Fandom and Karen Hellickson's Fanish Field of Value. So it's all economy all the time. See you next time.
Yay. Sounds good.
Yay. Oh, and join us all on Fixerpology LiveJournal and Dream With Accounts. You can find links to all the stories that we've recommended, and feel free to leave any comments. Thank you.